Thursday, February 15th, I was up at the unwelcome hour of a little past 7 to watch my appearance in the Today Show. It went along fairly well. It was a discussion of the art objects and paintings that had come to the White House since we ourselves arrived. And it began in the green room with me sitting on the Daniel Webster sofa, telling about the silver coffee urn that had belonged to John and Abigail Adams. And it was rather stiff downstairs, but the second half, when we moved upstairs and were talking about the paintings, was warmer, I thought, and my love for them came through. I had done it under bad circumstances. I had meant to immerse myself in the facts and the feelings of each gift on the weekend before I did the show on a Monday morning. I like to read and study and be full of anecdotes and ready phrase. Instead, it had been a very bad weekend. I was bogged down in gloom and inertia and in wanting, as the very least I could do, to sit and listen and talk to Lyndon. And so I did not apply myself to the program. So actually, I was rather pleased that upstairs it went along well. Fairly articulate, and some of the warmth and love I feel for the paintings came through as I looked at the Winslow Homer and the Sully and the Mary Cassatt. And then, oh horrors, as I began to talk about the Robert Henri and turned it, the camera went back instead to the Sully once more. I guess the Henri wound up on the cutting room floor. I was furious. We either must follow these things through to the very end, we must have that right, or we mustn't sign up for them. It was loose and slack and inefficient, and I was angry at myself and disappointed in my staff. But no time to mourn, I dressed quickly and said goodbye to Lyndon and caught the shuttle to New York, Bess with me. We went to the Hotel Pierre. With that sense of excitement I unfailingly feel when I go to New York. Miss Trez was there with clothes for Marquise, and I decided on a summer suit in yellow cotton and yearned for 2 more, but they're so expensive and I get scared when I count up the prices. We had a steak for lunch. Mr. Stravopoulos came over, and I tried on evening dresses and selected 2. A pink embroidered with flowers that looks like a Botticelli girl dancing in Adele, and a cerise chiffon. And then, with Bess, I drove to the Decorative Arts Building and looked for dining room chairs at Kittinger and Wood and Hogan and Baker's. A few people stared at me and whispered to their companions, but mostly Bess and I were left entirely alone and conducted our business quite happily and fairly quickly. I was back at the hotel by 4, had a good long rest, read a magazine, and then Mr. Jack and Eddie Sins arrived, and I went through the ritual of getting my hair done up on top of my head and my face made up with false eyelashes, and put on the beautiful Solame coat and dress. The fabric had been given to me by a visiting chief of state. It's the sort that when you get tired of wearing it, you can burn the fabric and there'll be a residue of gold in the pot, they told me. I studied the guest list, and then with Linda, who looked regal in a white dress with heavily beaded sleeves like a coat of mail and her hair piled high on her head, and Chuck and Bess, the 4 of us went to Mary's house. There were photographers waiting for us at the steps. We paused for pictures, and then inside, to the welcoming elegance, the beautiful paintings, Matisse, Monet, Utrillo, Van Gogh, an impression of brilliant splashes of color against a white background, and flowers everywhere. This is a sort of sabbatical for me, only it's not that rare, really. I go about twice a year for something gay and lovely at Mary's. There were about 30 guests for dinner, many of them planned for Linda, the John Flemings, the young Carter Burden. In her early 20s, she's the youngest woman to have ever made the best dress list. And I, like every other woman in the room, took in carefully the covered-up white elegance and the simplicity of her dress. It was actress Kitty Carlisle, Mrs. Moss Hart, Warren Lynn, Dick Adler, lovely Jean Murray Vanderbilt, and I could thank her for the dear letter she had written Lyndon, Chris Brody, Mary's step-grandson who had worked one summer at the White House, David Merritt, and John Loeb Jr., Linda's old beau, and Giancarlo Uzielli, Ann Ford's husband, who told us that she was off skiing with Charlotte. I sat on Paul Hoffman's right, with John Fleming next, and close to Mrs. Richard Rogers, who in a delicately feminine print looked like she ought to be sipping lemonade in a summer house and talking about the culture of roses. A very perfect lady, a charming woman. It was a very civilized, beautiful evening, delicious food, good conversation. Paul Hoffman talked of the worldwide revolution in every aspect of living, social, cultural, economic. Perhaps it takes a blanket phrase like that to explain what's happening to us. And I casually brought up to John Fleming the subject about a document concerning the Louisiana Purchase. Had he heard of such on the market? Someone had told us about it and was even considering, very tentatively, purchasing it for the library. It's in the hands of a gallery, something like Nerdler's, I believe. And to my surprise, and I almost think to his, he said, "Shall I tell you something? That came from me. You're talking about the Engelhards." I was in part embarrassed. I would never have him think that we were trying to purchase it for less. And in part amused, because it fits so well into the It's a Small World story. With the champagne, Chuck rose and made a toast to Mary. Adequate and not as good as I've heard him make. And there was a toast to the president. And then John Loeb rose and made a very nice toast to Chuck, identifying himself as one of the also-rans. And then, as we rose from the dinner table, other guests began to come. They were very casually introduced, and I'm sure I did not see them all. Quite a contingent from the newspaper world, the Turner Catledges and the Gardner Coles, and Margaret and Clifton Daniel. I told her we had Mrs. Truman's portrait, and we must plan a day when she could be sure to come and get all of the Truman old-timers and have a party when we hung it. And George Hunt, the editor of Life magazine, with whom Liz seemed to spend the evening. And then Arthur and Matilda. The gnome-like little Leonard Lyons, who's probably been to more parties than any human being in New York. And I recognized a familiar name, Robert Massey, as the author of the current bestseller, Nicholas and Alexandra, and told him I had bought his book to send to a friend, Margie McNamara, and was looking forward to reading it sometime myself. He flabbergasted me by saying, "Well, I sent you a copy, and I got back a very nice note from Bess Abel." I'll guarantee if someone had sent me a book about the cultivation of copra and bongo bongo between 1896 and 1916, it could have lain on my desk forever, but not a book I wanted to read. And then he further amazed me by saying, "You remember I met you at the ranch. I had come out to do a story about you, and I wound up helping you write a speech to talk to the home economics people," I think he said, "in Detroit." Anyway, I got a D- in memory. For friends from the designing world, cute little Mrs. Richard Raines, Adele Simpson's daughter, Molly Parnes and her son, and several who are helping us put on the style show for the governor's wife, Nancy White of Harper's, and I think Eleanor Lambert. Bobby Sarnoff's were there, and the Edward Warburgs, G. Stephen Currier's mother, and Ed and Alice Weisold, Ed looking very weary, and saying that he was getting discouraged about public service. And Mrs. Enid Hope, thank goodness I remembered the fountains, and was quick to speak about them, and she equally quick to say how delighted she was to be privileged, as she expressed it, to put some fountains on their lips where they will frame the Jefferson Memorial and the White House. There was Mary at a tree. We talked about the bust of Stevenson and the presentation at the White House. And some of Mary's regular bachelors, Colonel Sergei Obolensky and Major Alexander Seversky and General Coulter, an attractive young Ed Durrell Stone, Jr. But by far the most interesting moment of the evening for me was when I settled down on a couch with John Loeb. Sometimes you can feel it's quiet, even if there are 100 people at the party. He said something I shall remember with pleasure. "I never see a picture of you I like. And then when I see you, I wish there were a good picture. There's someone I want you to meet here." And he introduced him, Cecil Beaton. He'd done the sets and costumes for My Fair Lady, but I remember him as the photographer who does the Queen and all the royal family. And John Loeb said, "I'd like to arrange for him to come down to the White House and make a picture of you. Could you give him some time?" Whether it ever happens or not, I shall feel about him wanting to, like a child would feel about getting a very big lollipop. And he and Peter and I talked about the time we'd had dinner in the Abe Fortas's backyard with the McNamaras and Lyndon. And Linda had come bringing Chuck, the first time I had ever been aware of his presence. And all of us were, I think, wondering a little about it. There was music, but much more conversation than dancing. I saw that Mary had planned a midnight supper, small tables on the first floor living room. But a little past 12, I said goodnight and went home, leaving the carpenters and Bess and Rory Lynn and Linda and Chuck for the late hours of the young. And back at the hotel, I read myself to sleep.